We're going to begin today by doing what we did yesterday, and that is listening to some quiet, reflective, hopefully contemplative music to help us begin to wind down a little bit, begin to grow a little quieter, a little more calm from the inside out. And then I'll say a little bit more about today's topic.
Thank you.
For those of you who weren't here yesterday, my name is Mitch Finley, and this is the second in a series of sessions on contemplative prayer, specifically underlying theme being the theme of healing, specifically emotional and spiritual healing rather than physical healing. Today we're going to be talking about contemplative prayer in the form of sensory contemplation and using biblical models to do that with. If you don't have a Bible yet, you might want to get one. Folks in the peanut gallery there, yeah. because we're going to be referring to that a little bit. I would like to begin with these scriptural references that I've got on the board here. Luke's gospel in particular presents us with a Jesus who is a man of prayer and a teacher of prayer. And if you look closely, it's very easy to infer Jesus even as contemplative rather than vocalizing prayer, that kind of thing. So if you'd like to look up Luke 5, 15 to 16, and the first person who gets it, if you would read, somebody already got it, you want to read it aloud for the rest of us?
But now more than ever, the word about Jesus spread abroad. Many crowds would gather to hear him and to be cured of their diseases, but he would withdraw to deserted places and pray.
Okay, what was going on there? Remember yesterday when I talked about the commandment of Jesus in Matthew, the great commandment of loving God and loving our neighbor? This is Jesus giving a perfect example of this himself. Here are all these people who've got all these problems. You know, probably endlessly people with problems. But there comes a point where even Jesus says, you know, I got to get away. I've got to be alone with my Father in the desert. You know, spending time alone with God. In spite of the fact that there are all those human needs out there, all those people that need to be cured, all the people who are in need of hearing the word of salvation, and so on. But nevertheless, Jesus, you know, gets away from it and spends time in prayer. You know, he spends time loving his Father. Okay, giving us an example of our need to love God directly, not just through other people and serving other people. Our need to spend time alone with God as well. Okay, chapter 6, 12 to 13.
Now during those days he went out to the mountain to pray, and he spent the night in prayer to God. And when day came, he called his disciples and chose 12 of them, whom he also named apostles.
Okay, what happened there? What do you see happening in those lines? Just that little brief passage.
He prayed before making some big decisions.
Exactly. Exactly. Okay, prayer comes before choices, as far as Jesus is concerned. And there are other examples of this, too, in the Gospels. Okay, Jesus spends time alone, how long?
All night.
All night long. Okay, how many of you have ever spent all night long, you know, praying? Is prayer a value in Jesus' life? His own example tells us that it is. Absolutely. Nobody has to convince the Son of God of the need to spend time in prayer. Therefore, we who are, you know, members of his body in this world, obviously are called to give some expression to that in some way in our own lives as well. Okay? Luke 9:18.
Once when Jesus was praying alone with only the disciples near him, he asked them, "Who do the crowd say that I am?"
Okay, what's happened there? What's the connection between prayer and the rest of what you just heard?
It's together with some other people, and there's dialogue going on.
Okay, and not only that, but here a lot of scripture scholars and theologians suggest that this passage can be interpreted in terms of Jesus coming to an awareness of his own identity, of who he is. He's not just playing guessing games with the disciples, saying, guess who I am? Neener, neener, neener. You know, if there's nothing there about that at all. He's asking a serious question, trying to figure it out for himself, just like we do. You know, how much time do we give to prayer in the ongoing process in our lives of trying to discover who we are called to be here and now at this point in our lives? Okay, prayer is an important part of that. All right, 918? Mm-hmm. 928. Okay, who's got that?
Now about 8 days after these things, Jesus took with him Peter and James and John and went up on the mountain to pray.
Okay, transfiguration account. Okay. Notice, Jesus does not say, okay, disciples, let's go. We're going up on the Mount of the Transfiguration and I'm going to be transfigured. You know? He goes up on the mountain to pray. And the rest of the account develops out of that fact. Okay, what happens follows as a result of prayer. And he's calling his disciples to go with him into that situation. And any time in the Gospels when Jesus relates to the disciples, it's very easy for us, and even intended on the part of the authors of the Gospels, for us to interpret this in the sense of whenever Jesus says something about discipleship, or says, you know, has his disciples do something, he's talking to us. Because we are his disciples here and now. So we're called to be involved in that situation as well. This is an account that's often interpreted, the account of the Transfiguration, often interpreted by the great mystics in the Western tradition as an account of a mystical experience, or at least can be used metaphorically for mystical experiences that people in contemplative prayer experience in one way or another in their own lives. So we're, again, at least hinted at contemplative prayer there. Was Jesus a contemplative? Yes. Are his disciples called to be contemplatives? Yes. Even the most active of us. 11:1.
He was praying in a certain place, and after he had finished, one of his disciples said to him, Lord, teach us to pray as John taught his disciples.
Okay. Jesus has been teaching his disciples to pray long before we get to the point of him articulating the Our Father, or the Lord's Prayer. Okay? And it's in the context of praying himself that he becomes a teacher of prayer. We cannot be instruments, you know, we cannot teach others to pray if we don't pray ourselves. We can't speak of prayer to other people and help them to learn the importance of prayer in their lives, in our various ministries, whatever they may be, if we ourselves are not prayerful people. And what we're focusing on here in the course of these sessions is looking at prayer precisely as a contemplative pursuit. Not just something we do, but something that we become, something that we allow to happen to us. Becoming receptive and alert that we talked about yesterday. Okay, any questions about any of that? There's so much more we could do with this, but we just don't have the time. Are there any scriptural examples or references that are important to you that you'd like to mention at this point, or that you've noticed before in the past that have been helpful for you when it comes to understanding prayer and making it important in your own life?
Well, always the command to be still and know that I am God.
Sure.
But that's sometimes the hardest one to...
Well, yeah, and in a sense, that's very much what we're about here, is learning what it means to be still. You know, be still and know that I am God means be still and know that you are not God. Okay?
I guess what comes to mind, too, is you're saying that, but to focus on the time, when Jesus chooses the apostles, he spends a night in prayer, and then all the others was he was praying. It's not just a quick prayer, and then he goes out and chooses the 12.
Yeah.
He spends quantity time.
Exactly.
And so often in our hurried life, we think, well, quick prayer, and then we have to make a decision.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, to allow the time for contemplation.
Yeah, yeah. Ultimately, I think what we're talking about here is living our entire lives in a climate of prayer. You know, so that the time that we spend formally giving ourselves to contemplative prayer in one form or another is like spending time exercising or eating a meal or whatever it might do. It affects our whole the whole rest of our existence. So that the way we go about doing our work is impacted, is affected by the fact that we spend time in prayer. And the fact that we pray in other ways all day long, for example, is affected by that time that we spend just for a few minutes each day in contemplative prayer. You know, I think prayerful people pray all the time in one way or another. They're constantly talking to God, you know, bringing it up in the most ordinary situations. You know, letting God know, asking God to be involved, asking God's help, thanking God, whatever it might be, you know. But the quality of all that is affected by you know, a commitment over a long period of time to be involved in a contemplative form of prayer of one kind or another. All right, let's see. When I use the term sensory contemplation, which is what we're going to be focusing on here today, I'm talking about. Remember yesterday I had defined contemplation as a long, loving look at the real. A long, loving look at the real. Not necessarily visually, although that's what we're going to focus on here, but just an awareness of, an opening ourselves to, an attitude of openness. Okay? Long, loving look at the real. Okay, and we can do this in terms of our senses, our five senses, okay? We can do it with touch, we can do it with smell, we can do it with sight, we can do it with all of our senses in one way or another as a way of being present to God. Okay, I'm going to focus on sensory, or on visual, visual contemplation today. And this is one that can, and we can spend a whole semester on this stuff, and I'm feeling a little frustrated, a little limited here by the fact that we don't have a lot of time. So I am cutting this down quite a bit, and we're just going to talk about visualizing today, okay? Visual contemplation, and there are three kinds of visual contemplation that I want to speak of. The first mode of visualization or visual contemplation, first, second, and third modes, okay, if you will. And I'm going to hopefully guide us through a little bit of an experience of this, of each of these modes, as we are here right now. Just because one of the best ways to learn about it is to do it. I can talk about it till I'm blue in the face, but if we experience at least a little bit of it, that, I think, is a better way of learning, you know, what I'm trying to talk about. So, I'll ask you to go ahead and put the notes aside, put the books aside. Go ahead and get into a comfortable posture of whatever kind is good for you. Take a deep breath, relax. Yesterday we talked about the grounding exercise that I led you through, where you became aware of yourself physically, basically, is what it was about. Okay? Close your eyes, take a deep breath, become aware of the various muscles and bone structures and so on in the various parts of your body. Don't try to change the way they are. If you feel tension, don't try to say, relax, relax, relax. Don't try to force yourself to relax. Just be aware of how you are physically right now. And then gradually move to that center of yourself, that heart center we talked about yesterday. Be aware of your deepest self, the very core of your being. And just kind of try to be there as best you can. And aware of God's love present in the deepest center of your being. Okay, now I'm going to ask you to, while remaining as quiet and relaxed as you can right now, I'm going to ask you to open your eyes, and I'm going to make a very simple symbol on the board here. Okay? This is just the simplest cross. Okay, look at the cross on the board. Focus on that image. Try to memorize what it looks like. It's not hard because it's so simple. Memorize the image of that cross. Now close your eyes again and visualize that image of that cross in your mind. Visualize the image of the cross in your mind. When the image fades, open your eyes again, look at the cross on the board again, and then close your eyes. And continue that process until you're able to just keep maintaining that image in your mind of that cross. Okay. Open your eyes again. The idea, this simple cross on the board is, all we basically have right here. Ideally, visualizing a symbol, an abstract symbol like this, would be something that you already have that you find helpful as a reminder of your faith or a reminder of God's presence in your life. It could be a picture. It could be an icon. Maybe from the Eastern Orthodox tradition of some sort. Anything that's helpful to you that kind of calls you back to an awareness of your faith and of your desire to be involved in a prayerful openness at this particular time. It could be a candle, a lighted candle. It's probably going to be something different for each one of us. But the idea is to use this as something to focus on while being open to God's presence in you and in all around you. It's a very simple form of visual contemplation, sensory contemplation, and one that deserves more time than we're able to give to it right here. But any thoughts about that? Does it seem to you like that would be good for you or not? Some people find this, again, each one of these, some people are going to find these helpful and others are going to find it not helpful at all. That's the nice thing about the fact that there are so many approaches to this available. Some people, that's just not how their imagination works. You know, a certain percentage of the population would not find this helpful at all, you know, as a way of praying. Other people would find it very helpful. And you know, would adopt it on a regular basis as a way of praying. But any thoughts or reflections on that? Yes?
One thought, Mitch, but correct me if I'm wrong, but my sense of the use of visual images in contemplative prayer, mm-hmm. perhaps an important point about it, is that it's important not to make the visual image the goal of your prayer. It is
right.
It is a pointer to something beyond, and so that when other thoughts arise in one's consciousness that distract,
right.
One can use the visual images very gently to get one back on track.
Exactly. Yeah. All of these are means to an end.
Right.
You know, religion is a means to an end. You know, so often we come across people who think that religion is an end in itself. You know, church structures are an ends in themselves, church doctrines and so forth. These things are all means to an end, and the end is, they are all means to nourishing our relationship with God and other people. When they become ends in themselves, then that's called idolatry. You know, when anything like that becomes an end in itself, then it's no longer helpful and it's no longer healthy. And we need to remind ourselves that, even the scriptures are again, metaphorically speaking here, or just as an image, we're supposed to allow the scriptures to be a means to our relationship, to a healthier relationship with God. You know, they aren't, the words of scripture are not etched in stone like this, you know. It's more like they're painted on glass, and we allow the light of God's life to filter through that glass with the words on the glass into our hearts. It's a means to an end. It's not an absolute. Okay, and none of these things are. They're all tools, and they're meant to be helpful. Okay, the second mode of visual contemplation is one that we've all, I think, seen used at one time or another, especially in sermons, you know, where a story from one of the Gospels, for example, will be used by the person giving the sermon to help us visualize this event in the life of Jesus, for example. Okay, Jesus meeting the Samaritan woman at the well, you know, and the preacher will describe for us what kind of a day it probably was. And Jesus was out there, you know, and he was hot, and he was just kind of walking along the road, maybe, and he was dusty, and he comes across the well, and he's thirsty, and, you know, and it kind of helps us to visualize this whole scene in our minds, okay? But when we use it as a method of contemplative prayer, we're going to be doing this for ourselves rather than having somebody else do it for us, okay? And we're not going to be necessarily limiting ourselves to a story that we have found in Scripture. We can kind of be a lot more flexible with this than we would be otherwise. So let's try that. Let's try this one for a minute. Okay. So go ahead and get back to your bouncing in and out of complete recollection here. But go ahead and get back into your recollected mode there, and once again, aware of your heart center and God's presence in your deepest self. Okay, visualize that you are living in the time of Jesus. Last night you heard that Jesus had come to town. A friend told you that Jesus was in town. But you don't know where Jesus is staying. You'd like to go see Jesus and hear what he has to say. But you don't know where he is. So you resolve to search for Jesus. You leave your house. Looks much like all the other houses in this narrow little street, Palestine. You leave the house. It's early morning. The smells of the early morning are still in the air. It's quieter than it's going to be later in the day. It's a fresh new day, and as you walk, you see a crowd of people way off in the distance, down by a lake. You walk through the narrow street, and you keep your eyes focused on that crowd of people, all of whom are turned away from you and facing toward the lake, and you're not sure what they may be listening to. What could they be paying attention to? What is it that's holding all those people's attention so well? Gradually, you're walking and walking, and eventually, you approach the lake, and as you approach, you realize that there's a man who's speaking to the crowd, and they're all listening very closely. He looks like an ordinary enough man. nothing special about his appearance. But based on the kind of attention he's getting from all these people, you wonder, could this be Jesus? He seems to be speaking with an authority that holds people's attention. He's speaking to them, and they have no trouble paying attention, listening to his every word. You work your way through the crowd, gently nudging people aside in order to get up to the front so you can see better. You hear Jesus speaking. He says, "The kingdom of God is like a buried treasure which a man found in a field. He hid the treasure again and, rejoicing at his find, went and sold all that he had in order to buy that field." Jesus' words burn in your heart. He touches something deep inside of you that no one has ever touched before. You wonder, how can you find this treasure that Jesus is speaking of? Then, as you're listening closely to his every word, he looks directly at you. Jesus looks directly into your eyes. Jesus looks directly into your soul. He knows the troubles in your heart. He understands. Without even speaking a word, you feel that he understands everything that you would like to say to him. Jesus speaks to you. He says, "Come follow me." "For my yoke is easy and my burden is light, and I am gentle and humble of heart. Come follow me." Can you follow me? Silently, in your own way now, respond to the Lord in whatever way you feel called to do so. He's asking you to follow him. Let yourself go in your own imagination and see what happens as you respond to his invitation to you. If your attention wanders, gently bring it back. Jesus is looking directly into your soul. He's asking you to come and follow him. What is your response? When you feel ready to do so, gently bring yourself back into this situation in this room. When you're ready to do so, open your eyes. Go ahead and take a deep breath. This is a much more concrete kind of visualization. It's not so much of an abstract approach to visualizing as the business of visualizing the cross in your mind that I put on the board. This is a way of putting yourself in the presence of Christ, of allowing him to ask you the question that is asked of you every single day, of allowing him to ask you the question that we all are called to respond to on a daily basis. But we're so familiar with the whole idea that sometimes we don't even bother anymore. So this is a way of allowing that to happen consciously on a daily basis in a contemplative kind of spirit, of answering that question consciously every day. Excuse me. What do you think of that? Any observations?
I thought it was good.
Questions? Okay. You prefer that to the more abstract approach? Okay.
At the risk of speaking too much, I have a question.
Go ahead.
I'm a little confused by it. It was very powerful, very vivid, very concrete. But it puts the focus on answering.
Uh-huh.
And my understanding of the goal of contemplative prayer was to create a space of receptivity.
Right.
So that God can speak to you.
Yeah.
That there are other forms of prayer for speaking to God, but that this was the purpose of contemplative.
Ideally, when you get to that point where I said, you know, let your imagination wander and let it go where it's going to go, you know, you might find yourself saying, I don't know what to answer. I don't know how I can answer. Help me to answer. Help me to know what I need to say here. And then, you know, gradually that may lead to a simple quiet openness and receptivity and alertness to wanting to hear what, you know, what God has to say to you in that situation. Certainly the idea is not to get hung up on a head thing and say, I got to think of what am I going to answer, you know, at all. No, so that's a good, I appreciate the question very much. Again, it's any of these contemplative methods are open-ended, and they're meant to be open-ended and lead to a point where we don't know where we may be drawn. Okay, but it definitely the underlying characteristic of all of these is openness, receptivity, alertness. You know, without any goal necessarily in mind. And as a matter of fact, contemplative prayer should have no specific goal. Yes.
In using this more recent method, do you use a written form to get you into this that you sort of go through? Mm-hmm. Or is it something that you have to generate in some way yourself?
You could. During the time of prayer itself is not the time to do that.
Right.
You should come up with something ahead of time.
Uh-huh.
And it might be just something very simple like this. And you might even use this one.
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe after a time, a number of days or weeks, this one is just not doing much for you anymore. So maybe you get an idea from reading the Gospels of some other situation that you can adapt.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe you become the woman at the well, you know, and Jesus comes up and starts, you know, and you get involved in that dialogue. Or maybe you're one of the people in the crowd for the Sermon on the Mount. You know, and you know those words, you know the Beatitudes so well already that you can hear Jesus speaking those to you. You know, and you just kind of let your imagination go, really. It's a very imagination freeing kind of approach to contemplative prayer. Okay. Yes?
There's a song that many Lutherans don't think is Lutheran, but it's in the garden. I come to the garden, and he walks with me and he talks with me.
Right.
That's a good one too, I think.
Oh yeah. Anything like that that will provide you with a setting, you know, a scenario, if you will, you know, can be used for this sort of thing. Okay. All right, let's try a third approach to this now, a third mode of visualization or visual contemplative prayer. Okay, once again, back to your heart place, quiet, eyes closed, breathing in a relaxed manner. I'm going to be providing you with a very general kind of structure, a very general set of images that you then are free to do whatever you want to, make whatever you want to of these images. Okay, present to your deepest center, aware of God's presence in you and in your heart and all around you. Think of a very idyllic scene, whatever that might mean for you. Might be a garden, might be top of a mountain, could be in a pasture of some sort, green rolling hills. Whatever idyllic means to you, your ideal idyllic setting. Place yourself in that setting, that idyllic setting. You look around, or you lift your head and you look off just in the near distance, and Jesus is standing there, beckoning you to come over to where he is. No words are spoken. Jesus does not speak. You do not speak. You simply move into his presence and you are there with him. You are there with the risen Christ. What do you see in his eyes? What do you feel being in his presence? Jesus is able to know you and accept you completely with no conditions, no strings attached, no demands that must be met. Total unconditional love. No explanations are required. Jesus lifts his arms and gathers you into his embrace. How do you feel? How do you respond? How do you react? You step back, gradually allow the scene to fade. And bring yourself back once again to this room and this place. We're doing these too fast because we don't have the time. But you get the general idea, I hope. The ideal is to let these things go on for as long as they go on for you. You know, if it lasts 30 seconds, if it lasts for half an hour, then half an hour. Okay, any observations about that last approach? Or comments or questions? Again, this can lead to something beyond itself. Ideally, it will lead to simply a being present to God's love. You know, there's no need for words. That's the advantage, or that's one of the characteristics of contemplative prayer. Gradually, we move through our method beyond that to a place where there is no need for words, and we're simply present to God, and God is present to us, and we rest in that presence and in that love. And we find in that resting in that presence an experience of healing and nourishment and care and strength and new energy and ability to go on with our lives in a way that is that's different if we don't do that. Questions or objections or anything at all? Okay. One of my favorite ways to conclude any form of contemplative prayer, any time that I've spent in contemplative prayer, is with the Magnificat, which of course is Mary's prayer in Luke. We sang a version of this at Vespers, the night before last, I think. Something else undoubtedly is your favorite. One of the Psalms, for example. We're going to be talking about the Psalms in a later session as a part of one of the other contemplative prayer methods. But I like to read this as a way of allowing myself to resurface and kind of come back from the time I've spent in contemplative prayer, because it sums up so much for me. It's Luke 1:47 and following. My soul magnifies the Lord, and my spirit rejoices in God my Savior, for he has looked with favor on the lowliness of his servant. Surely from now on all generations will call me blessed, for the Mighty One has done great things for me, and holy is his name. His mercy is for those who fear him from generation to generation. He has shown strength with his arm. He has scattered the proud in the thoughts of their hearts. He has brought down the powerful from their thrones and lifted up the lowly. He has filled the hungry with good things and sent the rich away empty. He has helped his servant Israel in remembrance of his mercy, according to the promise he made to our ancestors, to Abraham and to his descendants forever. I don't know why I like that so much, but I do. I don't know, maybe it's just because I'm such a Catholic. I don't know. In the morning, it's the Canticle of Zachary, and in the evening, it's the Magnificat. Just kind of very traditional, you know, prayers. I was asked if I would read a little something from, for those of you who were not here yesterday, the two books that I'm recommending as kind of companion reading for these sessions are 101 Ways to Nourish Your Soul, both of these which I wrote and are available over in the store, and The Gospel Truth, Living for Real in an Unreal World, because they are both designed to nourish a life that allows room for contemplative prayer. But I was asked if I'd read a little selection from this by someone who's read the book, who's in the group. And so I thought I would select one of the 101 ways here, the 101 reflections, that has a lot to do with what we're about in this setting here, where we're attempting to put ourselves into a contemplative, prayerful kind of place in our lives. The title of this section is Listen to Your Heartbeat, and this is the 41st way to nourish your soul. And you might want to just kind of be in that receptive mode, you know, as you listen to this, because it kind of lends itself to that. Listen to your heartbeat. Listen. Listen. You are alive. You are a remarkable fact, a complete truth, an evident reality, a living and breathing human being. Listen to your heartbeat. You are alive. But listen to your heartbeat, your heart softly pounding in your chest. Nourish your soul by listening. You must be quiet in order to listen to your heartbeat. So be quiet and listen. Listen. Your heart pumps blood through your entire system. Ka-whump, ka-whump, ka-whump. Your heart beats in your chest efficiently. But what keeps it going? Do you will it to keep on thumping in your chest? No. It just happens. It just happens. But does anything just happen? No. Everything must have a cause. What causes your heart to keep on beating in your chest? Someone versed in physiology would tell you that your heart is a muscle about the size of your fist that beats about 70 times a minute and more than 100,000 times in a single day. Your heart pumps 5 quarts of blood through its chambers every 60 seconds and does enough work in 1 hour to lift a weight of 1.5 short tons more than 1 foot off the ground. The right side of your heart takes impure blood containing carbon dioxide from your body and pumps it to your lungs. The left side collects pure oxygen-rich blood from your lungs and pumps it to your body, and so on and so forth. But what made your heart start beating before you were born, and what keeps it beating now? Ah, that's the mystery. That's the mystery. We may describe the physiology of the heart and the various processes that characterize its functions until yon cows come home, but we still will not have answered this question. Only your heart, meaning now the center of your being, not a part of your anatomy, can tell you what keeps your heart thumping in your chest. Only your heart. It speaks a deep mystery into the silence of the mystery of your own being. It says that only your heart can tell you the answer to this question. But the answer is freely available for the asking, for the small and simple asking of the question. So, ask. Listen to your heart softly pounding in your chest. It pumps the blood, but what does the sound of your heart say? Does it speak? Does it speak to you? If you close your eyes, sit quietly, and listen, your heart will speak to you. It may say something like this: God's love, God's love, God's love. If you listen, your heart may speak these words to you or something like them. Something very like them. Your heartbeat speaks a mystery of love. So listen. Okay. Our time is basically up. Are there any questions or comments about anything at all? Curiosities? Yes.
Well, as we went along, I realized that I use some visualization for going to sleep. But when I'm praying, I try to use words.
Okay.
And so this is kind of a new opening. I mean, okay. I don't know. I have used some visualization with prayer, too. But I think we're into reading, writing, and words.
Yeah.
And so I have, you know, kind of a list of words that bring this feeling of presence. And,
mm-hmm.
But I appreciate the visualizing, the symbol,
good.
Picture.
Uh-huh. Okay. And again, the whole visualizing thing, there are some people, doesn't do a thing for them. You know? So we're going to be talking about the Jesus Prayer. We're going to be talking about centering prayer. We're going to be talking about Lectio Divina, or sacred reading, prayerful reading. And, you know, if this doesn't work for you, maybe one of those others will. Frankly, visualizing doesn't do a thing for me. I hardly ever use it. You know? But a lot of people really find it helpful, and that's great. We have to look for what helps us. You know, don't pray as you can, I think, is the most important advice when it comes to prayer. Don't pray as somebody else tells you you should. Mm-hmm. Okay, any other questions? Or yes?
Well, when I think of contemplative prayer, I think of a time that you have to have a time with no distractions,
uh-huh.
with where you can kind of leave this world, and you know, you just can't do that at your bidding whenever.
Yeah, yeah.
It's so hard to find. So I find myself seeking this. I can kind of tell when I'm feeling empty and kind mm-hmm. of distant, and then I can carve out blocks,
mm-hmm.
but it's real hard to do this on a daily kind of thing.
Uh-huh. Almost any day. I mean, I know exactly what you're talking about. Okay. I mean, I've been a busy husband and parent and worker for a fair number of years, and we've been through the whole period of, you know, babies and little kids, and now we've got teenagers and that kind of stuff. So I know what you're saying. But there is at least 5 or 10 minutes somewhere, I'd be willing to bet, that you can find. You know, a lot of people find that they've got to do this first thing in the morning, and they've got to be willing to get up 15 minutes before everybody else, or something like that, in order to do this. You know, but it can't, it's there, that time.
It's hard to limit it to 5 or 10 minutes.
Yeah, I mean, well.
I don't know. It seems like I need more okay. time than that to do.
Let me tell you a little story. Everybody recognizes the name Mary Higgins Clark, the mystery writer. I once interviewed her for a magazine article that I wrote, and she told me the story of how she wrote her first bestseller. Her husband had died, leaving her with 5 little kids. 5. But she knew deep inside that she was a writer, and she was gonna, by gosh, write, no matter what. So she wrote her first best-selling novel between 5 a.m. and 7 a.m. in the morning, 5 days a week, before her kids got up and before she had to be busy getting them to school. You know, we make time for what's really, truly important to us, what we really value. We will make time for it. You know, in a way, it can be a cop-out to say, I just can't point to you telling you. And now, not that morning is the best time for anybody. Some people find, you know, it's later at night. I know a very wealthy woman who gets up every day at 3 o'clock in the morning in order to spend an hour in prayer from 3 to 4, and then she goes back to bed. You know, for a couple hours till she gets up again. So it's all a matter of where are we going to find that time? Where are we going to make the time for ourselves, you know, to be able to do this?
It's a paradox, because even though it's supposed to be open-ended, it's a discipline anyway.
Sure.
And so you've got to make the decision, and it's got to be a discipline kind of thing in some kind of way. And then, you know, the eventual thing is pray without ceasing, and that our walk is a prayer, our other kinds of things are prayers too. And so it's a disciplinary action that you do, and yet when you get there, it's open-ended.
Right.
And so it feels, I mean, it just doesn't happen all of a sudden by some inspiration. We have to make it happen.
Sure.
But then when it does get there, then we have to let it go.
Yeah, it's important that once we've decided on a prayer time, that we do it whether we feel like it or not.